Okay, well, today we're going to see one of the applications of the boundary term that was introduced yesterday, because we're going to look at black hole thermodynamics. And I'm going to take actually a variety of different approaches to this, but one of them is going to be using that Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. So the first thing I want to do, though, is to kind of motivate the laws of thermodynamics, or the first law of thermodynamics, simply by, in a very empirical way, by looking at the Kerr solution and thinking about what happens if you throw a particle into the black hole and how the black hole changes. So let's start by reminding ourselves what the Kerr metric is. So that was our Kerr metric. If we kind of paired up, sort of completed the square and paired up our T and phi terms. And of course, sigma was R squared plus A squared cos squared theta, and delta, which determined the horizons, was a quadratic in the radial coordinate. And of course, if you remember, A was J over M, was like an angular momentum parameter. So if we want to find the area of the event horizon, so we're looking at the area when delta is zero, you sort of see that we've got a sine squared theta here, we've got R squared plus A squared, and if we integrate over the theta phi directions, this sigma kind of cancels with that one, and what we're left with is that the area of the event horizon is not quite 4 pi r squared. In these coordinates, it's 4 pi r plus squared plus a squared. And remember, r plus is this root of delta. So it's the root of the quadratic. It's where the event horizon is. So now let's look at what happens if we throw a particle into the black hole. So the idea here is we're going to be adding a little mass, so we're going to add a little delta m, and possibly we're going to change the angular momentum of the black hole as well. So we have to allow for a possible delta m and a possible delta a. Now, way back in the day, was it Stephen that proved the area theorem? It was, yeah. So we know that the area should increase. So that's basically proven in sort of classical general relativity by looking at the geodesic congruence that forms the event horizon, that's a sort of family of null geodesics, and then looking at the Einstein equations sort of projected into that sort of local frame of reference, and the fact that T00 is positive, so you have a sort of weak energy condition, that your local energy density is positive, tells you that if this congruence changes, it always shifts out. So that's kind of how that's proven. So let's have a look at what happens to delta A. So A is R plus squared plus A squared. So if R plus increases, A will increase. Or if little a increases, A will increase. So let's have a look at what that is. Well, we know what R plus is because we've got this expression here. So I first look at the R plus. If R plus changes, it changes because either GM changes or A changes. So all I've done in that first line is I've replaced my expression for R plus. And then I'm just going to tidy this up a bit because this term matches with this term and that one with that one. Okay, so now I've got something with a change in mass, delta m, and now I'm going to look at delta a, because my a was j over m, so delta a is delta j over m minus j delta m on m squared. And then the other thing I'm going to do is just, I'll need it soon. I'm just going to define this combination of A and R plus squared plus A squared, which is the angular velocity of the horizon. So we get that by kind of looking at gt phi over g phi phi as r tends to r plus. So now my delta a, so I'm going to go back to that expression there on the top board and just input what my delta little a is. So I've got a common factor of 8 pi over R plus minus GM. So the first term I just translate down. That's my G delta M. And then the second term, has both a delta J and a delta M in it. So I can do a little bit of cancellation here. And notice that in this last piece here, this J here is of course AM. So pulling this together, And using that expression for omega, I now have a common factor of r plus squared plus a squared there. So I can rewrite this. As delta m. So how does the mass of the black hole change? Well, the mass of the change in the overall mass or energy of the black hole is given as a combination of the change in the area and the change in the angular momentum, j. So if we compare this expression to our first law of thermodynamics, where we have a change in internal energy of TdS minus TdV and then all sorts of charges and their chemical potentials, then I see that this is really in this form. J is a charge, omega is its potential, and this is looking, should look like TdS. So what this suggests suggests a thermodynamic interpretation with entropy proportional to area, and then the temperature would have to be that function of R plus. Now, of course, if you just did this, you wouldn't say, oh, this should have a thermodynamic interpretation. Really, this was something that came about because it was noticed that the sort of classical theorems about black holes, like the area always increasing, or the fact that there was something called a surface gravity of the event horizon that was constant around the event horizon. So it was more just a noticing that there were parallels between what we knew classically about black holes and parallels with thermodynamics, plus the insight that if we didn't assign an entropy to a black hole, then thermodynamics would be very seriously violated in our universe, because we could just junk everything into a black hole, lose all our entropy by throwing it into the black hole, and then our universe would kind of get cleaner, but also violate the second law of thermodynamics, which people felt was pretty fundamental. So I think it's really the second law of thermodynamics that was the driving force behind all this discussion. But if one included a notion of entropy for the black hole proportional to its area, then you could maintain the second law. But it had this puzzling feature that you were associating an absolutely huge entropy to the black hole. So here, of course, our C's and H bars are all missing. But in fact, our entropy would have an h-bar on the denominator. And of course, there's no notion of microstates, or, I mean, there still really isn't, sort of. But nonetheless, it kind of made us all happier bunnies, this thought that we weren't just violating the second law. We could throw stuff into a black hole, but then it would get bigger. And in fact, the entropy increase due to the black hole getting bigger was always way, way greater than the entropy of anything you could throw in. So black holes are maximize entropy. But initially, it was proposed in this format, in the sense of S was proportional to the area, but the precise constant of proportionality was not known. Until in 1974, Stephen Hawking did a calculation of quantum field theory on the background of a black hole that formed dynamically and showed that if you had a pure vacuum in-state, then the out-state on Scry Plus was a thermal radiation bath with a particular temperature, which if we forget about A and R plus is 2gm, the temperature was 1 over 8 pi gm. So that gave that constant of proportionality as a quarter, hopefully. So let's see an alternative. So here I'm going to give a sort of a pseudo path integral approach. And I've put it in inverted commas because although we actually do use this notion of the Euclidean path integral when we think about gravity, it's not completely rigorous. You know, there are issues we don't really know how to deal with fluctuations because we know that, you know, there are sort of arbitrary many negative modes. So it's a little bit, you know, the fact that we don't have non-controversial theory of quantum gravity kind of indicates that we don't really know properly how to formulate quantum gravity. But in the 70s, Hawking, amongst others, was trying to develop this theory of quantum gravity. And the natural way to do it was to extend the notion of the path integral in field theory to a path integral over geometries. And so that's the general idea. Now, it's not rigorous, but as long as we kind of tiptoe and do things carefully and we don't sort of try and overreach, it should capture most of the physics of quantum effects and gravity. And actually, we do need to think about quantum effects in gravity because that's what Hawking radiation is. It's also how we calculate the inflationary perturbations and their impact on the CMB. And if you look at the CMB data, I think Andrew Little again reviewed this on Wednesday. I mean, that's, what he showed was this curve, with the fluctuations at each particular angular momentum scale, that was incredible. I mean, it's an amazing set of data where fitting that curve, which is purely theoretical, is spot on with the data. So, and that is obtained again by sort of this notion of saying, well, we don't know what quantum gravity is, but as long as we stay clear of the Planck scale, we can approximate our space-time by some sort of continuum and then look at quantum fluctuations around that. So it's in that spirit that this sort of approach works. So our partition function sort of typically is some sort of finite temperature, because of course I want to think about thermodynamics here, is a sort of trace of the energy over the temperature. So here this beta is 1 over T. So that's sort of schematically how we might construct the partition function. And of course our H would be an integral of a Hamiltonian density. So I can write it as 1 over beta integral d3x dt. Now at the moment I'm just being schematic, because what I want to do is to use that general expression to say that the appropriate thing to replace beta H with when we're doing manifolds is actually the Euclidean action. So that's what we would get. So we're sort of taking our path integral of just summing over geometries where we're going to specify our boundary conditions at the appropriate point, but we're integrating over geometries and we need to weight them, and we weight them by their action. So it's just like, you know, we take e to the is on h bar normally. So let's first ask ourselves about what do we mean by a Euclidean geometry. So we've spent our time so far thinking about Lorentzian geometries, and of course in a Lorentzian geometry, causal structure is important. And so for a Euclidean geometry, we simply wick rotate our Lorentzian time. So that just changes dd squared into minus d tau squared. And then our Euclidean metric is simply minus our Lorentzian metric with t replaced by I tau. As a general rule of thumb, now actually sometimes you have to do a little bit more to it, but that's the general rule of thumb. So our Euclidean action if I perform this set of transformations, I get my bulk term of the Ricci curvature and a boundary term of the extrinsic curvature. So we expect saddle points to dominate this path integral, which is classical solutions. But one of the things that we've sort of started off with, because we're looking at a finite temperature partition function here, we have to make sure our geometries correspond to finite temperature geometries, i.e. periodic Euclidean time. So that's our goal. We're looking for classical geometries with a given specific periodicity of Euclidean time. So let's look at our black hole and see how that fits into this picture. So I'm going to take Schwarzschild to illustrate the process. Straightforward. So our process is t goes to I tau, and then swap the sign of G. So I get what we call a Euclidean Schwarzschild solution. So it's just the same. It's a solution to the Euclidean. Riemannian, you know, it's a Riemannian geometry solution to the Euclidean field equations. So let's first deal with periodicity. So here we've got this glaring issue, which is what happens as r goes to 2gm. Now, when we met the black hole from a Lorentzian perspective, I talked about how to change coordinates, go to Kruskal's, extend across the horizon, then maximally analytically extend the space-time. But here, I can't go to r less than 2gm. For the Lorentzian space, if I went to r less than 2gm, it was a little bit worrying, but it was okay because t looked space-like and r looked time-like. So I still had a Lorentzian geometry, It was just like TNR had swapped roles. Here, if I try to go to R less than 2GM, I change the signature. So I can't do that. That can't be part of my Euclidean manifold. So the rule or perspective when Gibbons and Hawking were looking at this was to say, well, if 2GM is not a physical singularity for the Lorentzian metric, it should not be a physical singularity for the Euclidean metric. Therefore, R equals 2GM must be a smooth point here. It must be a smooth edge to this space-time.
R less than 2GM, that the metric became...
So if I just sort of said, let me just, you know, look at this metric, this is the solution to the field equations, then if I go to R less than 2GM, this is negative and this is negative. So it's completely different. I mean, it's not that it's not a solution anymore, it's just that it is a solution with signature 2, 2, which is not our physical... You know, we can't kind of, even if we try to wick rotate back, it would all get, you know, it's I suppose we would get an interior, but it's simply saying that the interior doesn't exist as a Euclidean or Riemannian manifold. So what I have to do is focus in on 2GM. So if I look at my metric near 2GM, I notice that the R piece is dr squared over R minus 2GM. And I can express that as a total derivative. It looks like d of root R minus 2GM. So here, so it's possible I could just try to look for a local proper distance. So it's not like R equals 2GM is problematic. It's not like it's sort of, you know, I can't redefine my coordinate. So the easiest way to find a new coordinate is to say I'm looking for a coordinate that's like the square root of R minus 2GM. It's going to be proportional to that, and I need to find the constant of proportionality. So 2 rho d rho is lambda dr, and therefore 4 lambda R minus 2GM d rho squared is lambda squared the r squared. So now I can find my lambda. By looking at this is what the R squared piece looks like near 2GM, and this is what it looks like in terms of rho. So if I set lambda as 8GM, then rho is the proper distance from that would-be horizon. So now I look at the tau part of my metric. 1 minus 2 gm on r is then, so it's lambda, which is 8 gm. Sorry, r minus 2 gm is rho squared on lambda. So it's rho squared on 8 gm times 2 gm. So that tells me that the tau r part of the metric becomes d rho squared plus rho squared d tau over 4 gm all squared. So now I see how to make this point r equals 2gm non-singular, because I've, with a bit of work, what I've done is I've rewritten, I've found new coordinates in the vicinity of 2gm that look rather like the origin of polar coordinates. It's d rho squared plus rho squared d chi squared. So here, this would look like rho squared or d theta squared. And the only thing I have to do is to give theta, tau on 4 gm, periodicity of 2 pi. So in other words, by looking at Euclidean Schwarzschild, and even without my agenda of wanting to have geometries that are periodic in time, I actually find myself led very naturally to a geometry with a periodic Euclidean time, and I have a very specific value for that periodicity here, 8 pi gm. So what does the geometry look like? Well, this is my r coordinate and this is tau. If I look at large r, then I simply have d tau squared plus dr squared. So that's flat. If I look at r going to 2gm, on the other hand, I have the origin of polar coordinates. So I start off with a periodic time, but flat, that's the cylinder, but then it has to curl round to smoothly close off, because at r equals 2gm, it's just the origin of polar coordinates. So the r tau part sections of the black hole geometrically look like this black hole cigar, as it was called. So that's what a Euclidean black hole looks like. So it's actually quite neat, the fact that the original calculation to prove the temperature of the black hole was done using QFT in Lorentzian space. So that's one whole set of tools. And yet here you've done no field theory at all. All you've done is looked at the saddle point. You've looked at a solution of the classical equations in its Euclidean form, and you find that you're inevitably led to a periodic Euclidean time, which is associated with a finite temperature. So there's lots of sort of parallels that keep going on here. It's not just one method that gives you this temperature for the black hole. So if I reinstate all these different constants that I always set to one, then this is what I get. So this is the Hawking temperature of a black hole. And in our sort of units, just to put some numbers onto it, it has, if we had a solar mass black hole, that would have a temperature of 10 to the minus 8 Kelvin. So the Hawking temperature of a black hole is absolutely tiny for astrophysical black holes. So notice this has given us this constant of proportionality. And so our entropy, we now know, is a quarter of the area in geometrized units. And then our Kerr T, I'm going to need that later. So that's our entropy, kind of. I've argued it just from the point of view of an exact solution, but I wasn't able to get the constant of proportionality without having a more definitive calculation of the temperature. So I can also ask whether this value for the entropy actually agrees with what we would get if we used our partition function to evaluate the entropy. So let me just convince you, you know, that everything is kind of wrapped up nicely or closing off nicely. So if I want to calculate my entropy from the partition function, then I need to know what my Euclidean action is. So in general, if we want to do sort of, you know, more exploratory thermodynamics, we do actually need to know what our Euclidean action is. So now we're going to do a computation of the Euclidean action of Schwarzschild. So we started off by just dealing with the issue of periodicity of Euclidean time for our geometry. Now we want to actually compute its action. So this was another reason why Gibbons' Hawking term was so useful, because if we look at our action for our geometries, if we have vacuum solutions, R is zero. And so this first integral is zero. And therefore, all of these black hole solutions, Schwarzschild, Kerr, would have zero action if there wasn't a boundary term. And obviously, that's not very helpful. So everything, if you like, is all tied up in that boundary term. So what we're going to do is we're going to take that black hole cigar and we're going to chop it off at some R is capital R. And then we're going to let that capital R tend to infinity. So that's how we're going to compute our action. So here is my delta M with an inward pointing normal. So the normal lies in our space-time. So the boundary metric is simply GTT tau tau, sorry, evaluated at capital R plus R squared d omega squared, my normal. Is proportional to d by dr.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that to compute the boundary term, I needed to have an extra piece of information other than the metric on spacetime, which was the embedding of the boundary into the spacetime, right?
Yeah, so that's defined by this. It's defined by little r is fixed. That's my definition of my boundary.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm just taking that cigar and I'm chopping it before I reach infinity. And that defines my boundary.
Okay.
So, you know, that's sort of, I mean, that makes sense geometrically because I can just draw it. And the embedding is this equation here. This is my one constraint. So my extrinsic curvature, which is the divergence of N, which is just really the derivative of R squared NR, and that is 2 over R in general at an arbitrary point for that M. Has two pieces. One is just the piece that comes from the fact that you've got this two sphere sitting there that's always got an increasing radius, and the other bit comes from the actual black hole geometry. Then I've got root h, which is r squared sine theta square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r. And so my k root h legible. So all I've done there is replace in, there should be an NR here, sorry. All I've done is replace the value of NR in that expression for K and then added in the root H. So none of this, apart from the sine theta, which is just the standard S2 volume form, none of this actually depends on T or R or theta. So we get a 4 pi beta coming from the integral over the two sphere. And then I multiply through this slot by root 1 minus 2 gm on R. And I get 2R minus 3 gm. So that's what I get for the integral of the extrinsic curvature. Now, That's a bit of a problem because R is big and we're expecting to let it go to infinity. So it looks like this boundary term is divergent. But it's also divergent if we take the black hole away. And therein lies our hope. So that's telling us that this boundary term is giving us trouble, but it gives us trouble even if we're in flat space. And so this leads us to the idea of renormalization. We're not exactly unused to the notion of flat space having an infinity associated to it. So why don't we do some sort of subtraction? We're going to subtract a sort of zero point energy. So the idea there is that we subtract a flat background. So a flat background would just be a pure cylinder here. And we take the action for the flat background and subtract that off.
Sorry?
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. Is it boundary is equal radius or equal time?
Sorry?
What's the... Is it boundary... I mean, how do you do the integral there?
Well, we integrate over theta, phi, and tau.
There is no integrate over R, right?
No, because the boundary is R is a constant. So R is not does not come into our boundary. Yeah. So the only things that parameterize the boundary are the two sphere that's missing from this picture and the d tau, which is the integral around that circle. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Okay, so we renormalize by background subtraction. So what is our flat space integral? So here, our flat space if I look at flat space in polar coordinates, then I know I have to match my flat space at the radial coordinate equals capital R, but I just have to be careful what I do with my time coordinate. So here, perhaps I'll just do this. This would be my flat space metric. So that's ds squared of delta m naught. So our boundary metrics must match. And so what that means is that dt squared has to be the same as 1 minus 2 gm over r d tau squared. So that means that if the periodicity of my tau coordinate is beta, the periodicity of my t coordinate is beta times what root of 1 minus 2 gm on r. So that's the only kind of subtlety in the process, that the periodicity of my background time is not quite the same. So the extrinsic curvature I can read off. So my n is minus d by dr as before. And so k is simply 2 over r. So my k naught is 2 over r. And then the root h naught, well, that's just r squared sine theta. So the integral of k root h naught is equal to 2 over r times 4 pi r squared times beta naught. So beta naught is the periodicity of capital T. So this is simply 8 pi r, and the periodicity, sorry, it's minus 2 on r because n is minus d by dr. So that's my periodicity, root 1 minus 2 gm on r beta. And so I get minus 8 pi beta r into 1 minus gm on r, plus terms that are order lower order in capital R. So get my Euclidean action, I take the first bit that I calculated, so that's minus 4 pi beta into 2r minus 3 gm, and then I subtract off my background piece, which is 8 pi beta r minus gm. So now you see that these two terms that are divergent cancel, which was what we wanted, and then everything else. So we have plus 12 pi beta gm minus 8 pi beta gm, which leaves us with 4 pi beta gm. And so we end up with beta m on 2. So if I just check that against the entropy calculation, so remember that
where's my beta?
Beta is 8 pi gm. So my entropy is beta squared d by d beta of the action divided by beta. So m is proportional to beta. So m is beta over 8 pi g. So all I get here is beta squared over 16 pi g, which indeed turns into a over 4 g when I replace back my beta with 8 pi gm, which is, of course, 4 pi r plus. So everything is nicely consistent. I've got this calculation of the action, which gives me the right entropy. I've got an argument just very naive, looking at the, you know, the exact solution and asking what happens if I throw a particle into the black hole. That gives me also a notion of entropy being associated with area. Here I've derived the temperature of a black hole by looking at the Euclidean geometry. That's in practice how, what we tend to do when we want to calculate temperatures. But there is also the alternative method of looking at field theory in the black hole background. So just to wrap up, Let me just play with my Kerr expressions a little bit. So on the far right-hand side, I've written down the entropy and the angular momentum, and then I fiddled with, you know, to write an expression for the mass, I've sort of fiddled with that polynomial, the quadratic, sorry, delta equals zero. So I'm writing my mass in terms of R plus an A, in terms of parameters that appear in my metric. So let me just play with these a little bit. So if I look at J squared, that is A squared M squared. So let me replace that with my expression for M. So M is related to R plus squared plus A squared divided by 2R plus times G. So I can, at the moment, all I'm doing is just kind of having a little meander through pushing symbols around. But then I notice I've got this R plus squared plus A squared, which I can relate to the entropy. Okay. Right. So now let me just look at 4 pi squared j squared over s squared plus 1. That is 1 plus a squared over r plus squared, which is r plus squared plus a squared over r plus squared. But now I notice that R plus squared plus a squared over R plus is the expression I had for M. So I can, if I square that, I can kind of get rid. I want to sort of move away from these expressions in terms of the metric parameters, something to do with geometry. Here, I can replace this 1 over R plus squared by an M squared. So I get 4g squared M squared divided by r plus squared plus a squared. But now I can get rid of that r plus squared plus a squared into an entropy. And so now what I've got is a relation purely between the charges. So I've got the charge J, the charge entropy, and the mass. So I rewrite this. As a simple formula for the mass in terms of the charges. So this formula here is sort of was first derived by Christodoulou and Ruffini. And it's a fully thermodynamic expression because I'm saying, I'm relating my energy to, in this case, the only charges I have, which are the angular momentum and the entropy. And then, following my sort of thermodynamic relations, omega should be dm by dj at constant s. So if I keep s constant, and then I just look at what is dm dj, well, I can do dm squared by dj very simply. So here I get just j over s. So my J here is AM. So on the top line, I've got pi AM. Meanwhile, on the bottom line, GS is pi R plus squared plus A squared. And I've got an M on the bottom as well. And so the M's cancel, the pi's cancel, and I am indeed left with the expression that I claimed for omega. But I didn't use it when I was deriving this integral formula here. Similarly, T should be dm by ds at constant J. So that would give me 1 over 8 pi gm, and then pull the s inside here, and I get 1 minus 4 pi squared j squared on s squared. Then I replace j by am, and I replace s by r plus squared plus a squared. And it boils down to this. And then I simply have to do a little bit of footwork here. So in the inside this bracket, I've got r plus squared minus a squared, but then I use the fact that r plus squared plus a squared minus 2gmr plus is 0 to end up with which I hope is what I wrote down over there. I'm always worried about factors of two. But anyway, so these are, if you like, chemical, oh, I wish they'd come in, chemical expressions for black hole thermodynamics. So it's kind of, you know, we started off by looking at geometries, finding expressions for things in terms of parameters in the metric, values of our coordinates in the metric. But once we've got our thermodynamic quantities, we can always re-massage them into these actual genuine thermodynamic potentials or thermodynamic expressions, which allows us to explore the phase space of the black hole thermodynamics, and sort of it's sort of become, and this is one of David's one of the leaders in this area, it's become known as black hole chemistry. So I wanted to just at least get that phrase over there, and so that you appreciate your tutor all the more. Okay, that's the end of today's lecture.